Picture this. You've built a brand new AI voice app.
Right.
You plug in the industry gold standard for transcription, which is, OpenAI's Whisper. You hit record, you speak a casual sentence in Mandarin, and you just wait for the magic to happen.
As you do.
Exactly. But the text that comes back is just completely mangled.
Always.
Like entire clauses are just missing, the homophones are hilariously, disastrously wrong, and, you aren't crazy and your code isn't broken. So, okay, let's unpack this. Because to figure out why the default Western AI just failed you, we are opening up a really gritty step-by-step technical runbook today.
Yeah, it's a fascinating
It
source.
really is. It's from an engineer who basically had to abandon that default standard just to survive the wild duct-taped reality of building production-grade AI.
I mean, it's an incredibly common developer nightmare. Oh,
Yeah.
absolutely. You pull in what literally everyone tells you is the absolute best tool on the market, and it instantly shatters upon contact with reality.
Right, the real world is messy.
Extremely messy. And this specific runbook we're looking at, it's called the Dubao STT Integration Guide. STT standing for speech to text, obviously.
Right.
And it just gives us this really raw look at how a developer actually navigates that failure. Because artificial intelligence, it isn't a single, monolithic, perfect brain.
Far from it.
Exactly. It is a highly fragmented ecosystem. And navigating it requires really understanding the severe limitations of generalized models when they're forced to deal with highly specific, localized problems.
So let's look at the actual mechanics of why that failure happens in the first place. We have this engineer, right? And they need Chinese speech to text.
Right.
So they start with Whisper. And Whisper is trained on an absolutely massive global data set. It's the baseline for almost everyone right now.
It is, yeah.
But real people do not speak like the clean, sanitized data that a global model prefers.
Exactly. I mean, Whisper excels at formal speech.
Like reading a script.
Right. If you read a perfectly enunciated news broadcast in Mandarin, Whisper handles it beautifully. It's
Yeah.
flawless.
But that's not how we talk on the internet.
No, not at all. And the runbook author noted that as soon as the audio switched to casual, everyday Mandarin, Whisper just heavily
It
struggled.
just dropped clauses left and right.
Entirely. And the reason comes down to the chaotic nature of colloquial speech. We slur our syllables together. We use hyper-regional idioms. We rely on filler words constantly.
Right.
And Mandarin, especially being a tonal language, it relies heavily on context to differentiate words that sound identical but mean completely different things.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So a generalized model, it simply doesn't have the deep, concentrated cultural context to decode a slurred, casual sentence in the way a native speaker would.
It's basically like taking a rigid, formal academic dictionary into a room of teenagers arguing in a group chat.
Huh, that's a great way to put it.
Like the dictionary technically contains the language, but it is completely useless for decoding the actual vibe or the slang or, the context of what's happening.
Precisely.
So to fix this, the developer switches over to Dubao. Specifically, they use the Volsungene Seed ASR Big Model.
Right, which is quite a mouthful.
It is.
Yeah.
But it's built by ByteDance, the company that runs TikTok. And the runbook notes that the difference in accuracy is basically instantaneous, night and day.
Yeah.
Dubao just effortlessly handles the colloquial speech, the filler words, the crazy dialect inflections.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it highlights something crucial for anyone building global software.
Which is.
That Dubao is a regional model. It's built by a Chinese company. So its training weights are heavily, heavily biased toward the massive chaotic reality of everyday Chinese audio.
It actually knows how people speak there.
Exactly. It has internalized the cultural cadence. And bringing in that local expertise doesn't just improve the accuracy, it dramatically changes the unit economics of the whole application.
Right, the cost.
The runbook points out that Dubao is roughly 2.5 times cheaper than standard Whisper.
2.5 times, and the latency is significantly lower too, right?
Oh, massively.
Because the runbook says for short audio clips, it returns the transcription in just 2 to 4 seconds.
Oh, yeah.
And when you're building a voice app, a 2-second delay, that feels like a quick
It's
breath.
natural.
But a 10-second delay, that feels like your app is completely frozen.
Users will just close it.
Instantly.
Yeah.
So the business case here is completely undeniable. It's cheaper, it's faster, and it's vastly more accurate for this specific demographic. So
Right.
the developer naturally decides to pull the trigger and turn Dubao on.
Which is where the real fun begins.
Exactly. Because Actually, switching this service on is an absolute nightmare.
It really is.
The runbook treats the developer console less like a control panel and more like a booby-trapped labyrinth.
Yeah, navigating a massive cloud provider's console is often the most dangerous part of any integration.
Just clicking the wrong button.
Literally. You are dealing with a user interface that is trying to sell you 50 different things at once.
Right.
And the runbook actually dedicates an entire section just to this because the margin for error is so high.
There's so many options that look exactly the same.
Exactly. There are multiple voice products that look nearly identical to the untrained eye. So the engineer explicitly warns that you must select the option labeled audio file recognition big model, or, you know, the Chinese equivalent in the console.
And if you misclick, you are immediately in trouble.
Oh, instantly.
Like, the author explicitly warns against picking anything labeled 2.0.
Which is the old version.
Right. 2.0 sounds new, but it's old. And you also have to avoid anything labeled streaming.
Yes, and this is a really critical distinction in network architecture.
How so?
Well, streaming usually requires a protocol called WebSockets.
Okay.
And that keeps a continuous open two-way pipe between the client and the server. So,
yeah.
Like, you talk and it transcribes simultaneously.
You make a phone call.
Exactly like a phone call. But the big model we are discussing uses a standard REST API.
Which is different.
Very different. It's a completely different protocol where you send a complete file and you just wait for a complete answer.
Like sending an email.
Right. And if you mix these up in the console, the server literally cannot understand the language your code is speaking.
And the developer highlights exactly what happens if you get this wrong. Because if you accidentally, you know, wander into old developer forums looking for a tutorial.
Which everyone does.
Of course. You'll see people talking about authenticating with bearer tokens and using WebSockets. And if you copy-paste that old code into this new big model system, the runbook guarantees you will just hit a massive wall of HTTP 400 errors.
Yeah, and a 400 error, for those who don't know, is the server's standardized way of telling you that you've sent a bad request.
Right.
The syntax is wrong, or the protocol is wrong, or the credentials just don't match the endpoint.
It's just a hard rejection.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah.
It means the server rejected you before it even tried to process your audio.
Which is so frustrating. But that brings us to, honestly, the most infuriating trap in this entire setup.
The secret key.
The secret key. Gotcha. So you finally navigate to the page containing your security credentials, right? And the ByteDance console hands you three distinct items.
Right.
It gives you an APP ID, an access token, and a secret key.
Three things.
And the runbook author spent hours trying to figure out how to mathematically sign their requests using that secret key, only to discover that the secret key is completely useless for this specific API.
It does absolutely nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah, the V3 Big Model API authenticates exclusively by passing the APP ID and the access token in the request headers.
Just those two.
Just those two. The secret key is basically a phantom element.
Yep.
It has zero function in this transaction.
Okay, I have to challenge this because it defies all logic.
Yeah, I know.
Why is enterprise software designed like an escape room? I mean, why would a multi-billion-dollar enterprise infrastructure company give a developer a literal labeled key right next to their other keys if there is no lock for it to go into?
It does feel insane.
It feels like malicious design.
I get that. But it isn't malicious. It is basically a manifestation of legacy tech debt at an immense scale.
Tech debt.
Right.
Yeah.
You have to understand how enterprise platforms like Volsungen evolve over time. They don't just rewrite their entire ecosystem overnight.
Because they can't.
Exactly. They have to constantly migrate thousands of clients from older systems to newer ones.
Okay, so the older versions actually needed that secret key.
Precisely. The older APIs, the ones the runbook specifically warned us to avoid, they likely use a really complex authentication scheme.
Where you had to sign the request.
Right. The developer had to use that secret key to cryptographically hash their requests. But the new V3 API, it simplified the process. It only requires the token.
Okay, but then why show the secret key at all?
Because the user interface generating those credentials is a shared component. It's used by dozens of different internal ByteDance services.
Oh.
Yeah. The UI team leaves the secret key field visible, because some legacy service somewhere on the massive platform still requires it.
That is so messy.
It is. They leave behind these digital ghosts that end up haunting new developers who are just trying to rigorously follow the documentation.
It's literally like buying a brand new car and finding a massive red switch on the dashboard.
Yeah.
And you spend 3 days reading the manual to figure out what this switch does. And the mechanic eventually tells you, oh, it used to deploy a parachute on the 2018 model.
Right, exactly.
And while it doesn't do anything now, it was just too expensive to redesign the plastic dashboard molding.
Yep.
So you just have to ignore the giant red switch.
That is the perfect encapsulation of enterprise tech debt. You really have to learn to ignore the buttons that no longer do anything.
Wow. Okay, so our developer finally escapes the console. They have the correct APP ID. They have the access
They're
token.
ignoring the decoy secret key.
They are ignoring the decoy secret key. So now they actually send the audio file. But the way this API communicates back is deeply unnerving.
It's very strange.
The runbook describes an architecture called a two-step async REST flow.
Right, and there's a good reason for this. Because transcribing a 2-minute audio file takes compute time.
It's not instant.
No, and you cannot hold a standard REST connection open for that long.
The connection would just time out.
Exactly. The server would drop you.
Yeah.
So the architecture requires you to submit the audio file to one specific endpoint, let the server accept it, and then your code must continually pull a completely different query endpoint to ask for the status of the transcription.
You have to keep knocking on the door.
Basically, yeah.
Right. But, okay, in a normal system, when you drop off a package or you submit a job, the server gives you a receipt.
To tracking number.
Yeah, it hands you a task ID. It says, here is your ticket number. Come back to this URL with this number to get your text.
Right, that is the standard human-readable paradigm.
But this API doesn't do that. The API absolutely refuses to give you a task ID.
Yeah.
Instead, the developer has to mathematically generate their own universally unique identifier, a UUID, on their own machine. You literally generate a 36-character string, slap it into the HTTP header under XAPI request ID, and send it to the server.
Right.
Your generated UID becomes the official task ID.
Which is wild. But
Right.
if you understand the sheer scale of the infrastructure, pushing that UUID generation to the client side is actually a brilliant architectural decision.
Really? How does making the developer do the work help the server?
Think about the database mechanics for a second.
Okay.
If ByteDance is receiving, say, 10 million audio clips a second,
Which is possible for TikTok.
very possible. And if their server has to generate a unique ID for every single one of those, it has to lock a database row, check that the ID hasn't been used, assign it, and write it.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, that creates a massive computational bottleneck.
Right.
But a UID generated on the client side relies on the client's MASC address, a timestamp, and random noise.
They're all unique.
Right. The mathematical probability of two clients generating the exact same UUID is practically zero.
Wow.
So by forcing you to bring your own ID, the server skips the database generation entirely. It just takes your string, attaches it to the audio, and moves on instantly.
Okay, that makes sense from an engineering perspective, but it leads to a terrifying developer experience.
It really does.
Because here's where it gets really interesting. Because you brought your own ID, the server doesn't feel the need to echo it back to you.
No, it doesn't.
When you hit submit, the API just returns an empty JSON object, literally two curly brackets,
What?
along with a basic HTTP 200 success code. That's it. No confirmation message, no task received, just empty brackets.
And it gets better because when the developer's code pulls the query endpoint, while the audio is still actively processing, the response is exactly the same.
It's also, the runbook is very clear that there is no in-progress status.
None.
There is no field that says queued or processing 50%. It is a purely binary state.
Yeah.
You are essentially sending a massive data file into the absolute void.
Like texting a brick wall.
Exactly. You get a no typing bubbles, no read receipts. You are just staring at empty brackets, wondering if your code is broken, until suddenly a perfectly formatted transcription essay just drops into your lap.
And what's fascinating here is that the runbook author actually admits they initially thought their code was failing because of those empty brackets.
I would too.
Any normal person would.
Yeah.
But again, look at it through the lens of computational overhead.
Okay.
If the server has to maintain a state machine for every single request, updating a database from receive to queue to processing, and then format a custom JSON response for every single poll,
That's a lot of work.
it burns massive amounts of server power. And for what? Just to make the human developer feel better.
Right, it's basically paying for the compute power of reassurance.
Exactly. Returning an empty JSON object strips out all the overhead of handholding. The machine doesn't need a read receipt to function.
It's just machines talking to machines.
Right. It teaches developers a harsh but necessary lesson. Do not project human psychological needs for reassurance onto machine-to-machine communication. Trust the empty bracket.
Trust the void. Well, trusting that silent API is fine when everything works perfectly.
Sure.
But ByteDance's servers aren't immune to physics.
No server is.
Submarine cables get cut. Authentication servers crash. What happens to the end user when those empty JSON brackets never turn into a transcript?
Then you have a problem.
Right. How does a developer guarantee the app actually works when things go wrong?
Well, that requires engineering resilience. And honestly, before the developer even worries about the server crashing, they have to handle the messiness of the real world on the client side.
The messy audio files.
Exactly. The runbook details how different chat platforms send completely different audio formats.
Yeah, this was a really fascinating detail to me. If a user sends a voice memo from Telegram, it arrives at the developer's app as an audio file.
Right.
But if they send it from WhatsApp, it's typically an audio MP4.
And you cannot just blindly forward those raw byte streams to the Dubao API and hope the AI figures it out.
It'll just fail.
Usually, yes. The server's audio decoding pipeline relies on explicit file signatures. So the developer's code has to actively intercept the audio, inspect the MIME type, and explicitly map it to Dubao's accepted format strings.
It has to translate it first.
Exactly. So the code literally translates Telegram's AUG into an explicit AUG tag and maps WhatsApp's MP4 into an M4A tag.
Wow.
Yeah, it requires highly intentional data normalization before the AI even touches the file.
And alongside that data normalization, the code also has to handle the money.
Yes, the billing.
Because Dubao bills based on the duration of the audio processed, but most AI applications, you know, they're built around tracking tokens.
Right, which is how text-based AI bills you.
Exactly. So the runbook author wrote a conversion formula to translate audio duration, which the API returns in milliseconds, by the way, into a token equivalent for unified billing.
So they can keep everything on one dashboard.
Right. They convert the milliseconds to seconds and multiply by 200. But crucially, they engineered this as a fire and forget background process.
Yes. And fire and forget is a vital architectural pattern here.
Why is it so important?
It basically means the billing code runs entirely asynchronously from the main transcription flow.
Okay.
So, say the internal database that tracks your user tokens goes offline.
Right. A database crash.
The billing function might throw an error and fail to charge the user. But because it is decoupled, it never interrupts the core user experience.
The app doesn't freeze.
Exactly. The AI still returns the text. The app prioritizes the user experience over perfect internal bookkeeping.
Better to lose a fraction of a cent than lose a user.
100%.
Which brings us to the ultimate safety net that's detailed in the runbook, the fallback chain pattern.
The holy grail of reliability.
Right. Because if Dubao goes down, how does the app actually survive?
Well, the golden rule of production-grade engineering is that you never, ever rely on a single point of failure.
No.
So the developer built an automated failover system. The code iterates through what we call a chain of responsibility.
So it tries Dubao first.
Right.
Because, as we established, it is vastly superior for Chinese, and it's 2.5 times cheaper.
It's the ideal path.
But if the Dubao server times out, or if the API returns a 500 server error, or even if the local environment variables containing your credentials just fail to load,
the application doesn't crash.
Right. It catches the failure, gracefully falls back, and routes the audio to OpenAI's Whisper instead.
Seamlessly.
And if Whisper is somehow down, it falls back a third time, routing it to Google's Gemini.
It's an incredibly robust strategy.
Oh, I have to push back hard on this.
Okay, let's hear it.
Doesn't building this giant chain of fallbacks make the code incredibly bloated and slow?
What about?
Because we're talking about maintaining 3 completely different SDKs here.
True.
You have to manage 3 sets of API keys. Yeah. You have to monitor 3 separate billing dashboards. And most importantly, you have to write translation layers for 3 completely different API responses.
Oh, the JSON responses, right?
Yeah. Whisper might return a JSON key called text, while Dubao returns result.message. You have to normalize all of that so the rest of your app doesn't just spontaneously break.
It's a lot of work.
It's a ton of work. It's all of that engineering overhead, all of that bloated code actually worth it just to save a few seconds of downtime? Why not just pick Dubao, except that it will work 99% of the time and just let the 1% fail?
This raises an important question, but the answer is because in enterprise software, that 1% represents thousands of angry users.
Oh.
Yeah. The overhead you just described, the normalization, the three SDKs, the JSON translation layers, that is exactly the difference between a brittle weekend project and professional software.
So a weekend project just crashes?
A weekend project crashes when one dependency hiccups.
Professional software hides the chaos.
Right.
If a router in Beijing fails and Dubao drops the connection, your user doesn't care whose fault it is.
They don't care about the router. They just see your app spinning endlessly.
Right. They blame you.
Exactly. So the fallback chain is essentially an invisibility cloak for infrastructure failure.
Wow, an invisibility cloak. That makes a lot of sense.
Precisely. The fallback to Whisper, yeah, it will cost the developer more money for that specific request.
And it might drop a casual colloquialism.
Or misinterpret a homophone, as we know.
Mm-hmm.
But an imperfect transcription delivered reliably in 4 seconds is infinitely better than a perfect system that throws a fatal application error.
It keeps the momentum going.
The fallback chain guarantees that the user gets their result no matter what violent network storms are happening entirely out of sight.
That's incredible. So what does this all mean? We started this deep dive looking at a developer just staring at a mangled Whisper transcription, trying to understand why the default global standard was completely failing them.
Right.
And by unpacking this really gritty integration guide, we've walked through the hidden reality of building software that actually works in the wild.
It's a journey.
We've navigated the traps of the developer console, avoiding the digital ghosts of legacy secret keys.
Ignoring the red buttons.
Ignoring the giant red buttons. We examined the harsh efficiency of machine-to-machine communication.
Learning why generating your own UUIDs and trusting the absolute silence of MDJSON brackets allows these huge platforms to scale to millions of requests.
And we saw how resilience is engineered by anticipating failure, right? Normalizing messy WhatsApp audio files, decoupling the billing logic, and wiring together this elaborate fallback chain that translates different AI responses into one seamless experience.
Yeah.
It is a fantastic reminder that the slick, magical AI interfaces we use every single day, they're kind of an illusion.
They absolutely are.
They're held together by relentless, paranoid engineering and a patchwork of highly specialized models.
There's one lingering detail in all this, though, that points to something much, much larger. We spent this entire time talking about how developers have to meticulously translate messy human reality, you know, filler words, dialects, weird file formats into clean, standardized data so the AI can understand it.
Right, doing all the heavy lifting for the machine.
But as billions of people start interacting with these specialized regional AIs every single day, it won't just be the code that adapts.
What do you mean?
We have to wonder, how long until humans subconsciously start flattening our own regional dialects, dropping our filler words and altering the way we speak, just to ensure the machine understands us the first time?
Oh, wow. Changing the way we speak to appease the machines built to serve us.
Exactly.
That is definitely something to think about the next time you leave a voice note. Keep questioning the defaults, and we'll catch you on the next one.